The Carleton College Convocation Program is a weekly lecture series that brings fresh insights and perspectives from experts in a variety of fields. The program has a rich history dating back several decades. The selected convocation speakers assist the liberal arts mission of centering thoughtful conversations within education and beyond.
My name is Colin Creeves, and I'm
a senior English and theater double major with a Mars minor. As much as I'd love to chat about myself, my purpose here today is to introduce you to our convocation speaker, Brian Sostek, of the class of 1990. While attending Carleton College, Brian majored in English and spent much of his time participating in the performing arts, much like myself. Since graduating, he has lent his unique voice and physical talents to characters on the page, on stage, and behind the camera, and sometimes all three at once. For example, he very generously shared with me a filmed performance of his original play, Trick Boxing, a piece he created with his wife, Megan McClellan, in which they would switch between multiple characters at once on stage. For it, they also choreographed complex swing dance numbers that made my head spin and used puppets to portray the boxing matches to great comedic effect. They earned a well-deserved Ivy Award for the play. I mention this piece to say that he is a wearer of many creative hats, all of which he dons with spellbinding mastery. Now, he has not only worked with theaters such as the Guthrie, the Park Square Theater, and the Children's Theater Company, but he has also founded a company of his own alongside his wife, called Saucy Mechanics, through which they have devised many theater and dance pieces. In addition to using his skills to create art, Brian is also a prolific educator. He works primarily with the University of Minnesota, where he not only, of course, works with their theater and dance department, but uses his knowledge of neuroscience and behavioral psychology to better scientific pedagogy and communication in the university's School of Nursing, School of Medicine, and others. At all times, he is a coach of communications, helping students, faculty, and researchers better express themselves and their ideas to a wider audience and pertinently to strangers. In short, Brian not only embodies the great multiplicity that an English major promises, but he has paid his gifts forward to better the world around him. He is communications incarnate, presenting his ideas in many modes, between the written word, the spoken word, and physical gestus and dance. And he has used these many languages, so to speak, to encourage others to take advantage of them. He is a generous scholar, and I strive to be that kind of English major upon leaving here. Now, enough from me. Please join me in welcoming Brian Sostek back to Carleton College.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks very much. Good to be here. I was going to talk about theater, but Colin's already covered everything, so I'll talk about something else. No, I want to say hi to the strangers in the room and also to the friends here and also on Zoom. When I was first approached about speaking at Convocation, the thought was that I might talk about my 30-plus years of experience in professional theater and dance. And honestly, as absolutely scintillating as that would be, I suggested that rather than tell stories from the theater, I talk about a different topic that I thought might be not quite as scintillating, but would have a broader appeal. This topic, fear, failure, and catastrophe, and how those things relate to talking with strangers, is based on concepts that I've been teaching in workshops and classes for the past 20 or so years. And lucky for you, and pretty much everyone I teach, I am an expert in fear, failure, and catastrophe, thanks largely to my 30-plus years of experience in professional theater and dance. Okay, so speaking of my life in theater, and okay, I am gonna tell a few stories. I remember the first day I was in rehearsal for my second show I did at the Guthrie Theater. Now, during rehearsals for the first show that I had done there, at each break, the actors would retreat to this tiny little break room, drink bad coffee, and just yak, yak, yak. And so the second show that I did there, I was looking forward to doing the work, of course, but I was also looking forward to the community and the yakking, you know, as actors are wont to do. So on the first day of rehearsals for the second show, on the first break, I went to the break room and it was quiet. Any guesses why it was quiet? Yeah, no, we hadn't gotten a bad review yet. Those were to come later, but it didn't matter. I was an understudy, so it didn't affect me. No, it was because between the first show and the second show, a critical mass of actors had obtained digital devices. Yeah, now don't worry, this isn't gonna be the old man Sostek grumpy hour, talking about phones, cell phones, the old man grumpy hour. No, it's not gonna be that. It's because, look, I have a cell phone. Oh gosh, see, I already forgot to use it. I think it's really valuable. In fact, right now I'm gonna set a timer so I don't go too long over the 2.5 hours I have been allocated. Right, Noel? Okay, so I have a cell phone, I use it, I think it's great, but look, let's be honest, they've made it really easy not to talk with people, especially strangers. And then there was COVID, remember COVID? Think back, okay, you don't have to think back too far. That didn't help matters very much. So we have retreated. We've retreated from talking with strangers more and more. Let me ask you, how many of you have ever been in a room, an elevator, a hallway with a stranger? And instead of talking with them, you get your phone out and get real busy. Anybody ever done that? Okay, I'm guilty too, I've done it. You know, that's not inherently a problem, except that the more you don't talk with strangers, the easier it gets not to talk with strangers. Now, how about this? Have you ever been in the seating area of an imaging center with about, oh, 5 or 6 different strangers at 7:30 p.m. on a weeknight, all sitting around with those open back hospital gowns waiting to get an MRI, and you decide to start a conversation with everybody? No, anybody? No, I'm the only one? Okay, yeah. That's actually one of the failure stories I was gonna tell you, but I kind of already told you that, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself. We'll come back to that though. First, I wanna ask you actually a really important question. And when I ask questions, the way I hope it's gonna work is that you'll answer. But the best way to do this is just raise your hand and then I'll call on you. You can shout it out and I'll repeat it so that everybody can hear, okay? We'll see how this works. All right, so the question is, why talk with strangers? I mean, you probably know enough people as it is, right? So why bother talking with strangers? Any thoughts? And if you don't have thoughts, I have plenty. Hey, yes, there we go. You might learn something. There we go, that was on my list. Anything else? Yes. You might never see them again, a lost opportunity. There you go, that's great. Okay, anything else? Yes. It might be fun. All right, any other ideas? Yes. Ooh, I love that one. They're feeling just as awkward as you are. In fact, one of the classes that I teach is all about you are the stranger. Yes, Colin. They might need to talk to someone. Yeah, there are lots and lots. We could spend the rest of the time doing this. There are lots and lots of good reasons to give help, to get help, to learn something, to get a different perspective, to fight the machine. One of the things I love about talking to people in person is that at this point, it's really hard to deepfake a conversation with a real person. At this point, we'll see what happens in the near future. Here's another good reason to talk with strangers, and some people kind of got to this, just to connect with another human being. And you know, despite the cell phones and the pandemics, we are still really highly social creatures who actually need other people. In fact, our social, collaborative, cooperative nature is what has allowed human beings to develop to the point we have, and for better or for worse, to distinguish ourselves from every other species on the planet. We're really good at working together. Yeah, sometimes it leads to problems, like I said. So social connection, plenty of studies showing this, also make us feel better and live longer. So it's a win-win situation, right? Now here's a specific example of connecting with strangers and the power of connecting with strangers. I want you just to take a second here and think about some of your best friends. Just picture them. And now I want to ask, how many of them did you know before you knew them? You see what I'm getting at here, right? Yeah, I mean, at some point you had never met them and then you met them. Now granted, you might have heard about them or maybe had someone in common that you knew, but there was at least some degree of what I call in class strangerness. Yeah, you were strangers. You might not have been completely unfamiliar, but you were still kind of strangers. So for instance, here on campus, you might see the same person in class every week and never speak to them. You kind of know who they are, but you don't really know who they are. That's a degree of strangerness. And it's kind of like, Do you know the game, The Degrees of Kevin Bacon? Anybody know that game? Yes, some people do. So The Degrees of Kevin Bacon is this game where you determine how many degrees of separation you have from Kevin Bacon. Or if you're not a famous actor, you choose a famous actor and figure out how many degrees of separation they have. I actually have a Kevin Bacon number of 2, 3 different ways. You can ask me about that later. In any case, these degrees of strangeness exist for everyone, all right? So we've kind of talked about a lot of good reasons, and we could talk about a lot more good reasons to talk with strangers, but I think at this point we can probably agree there are enough good reasons that it makes sense to talk with strangers, yeah? Fair? And if you want to push back, you could say, no, I don't think there are good enough reasons, because it will get interesting. We'd have some protest in here. We might have some protest in here later, who knows? Okay, so if that's the case, if there are lots of good reasons for talking with strangers, why do people find it so hard? I mean, who here has ever felt a little uncomfortable just talking with a stranger? Great, yeah, okay. Or keep your hands up, yeah, there we go. Or going to a party where you didn't know anybody. A few more hands, okay. Or going to find a place to sit in the lunchroom in middle school. I probably should have given a trigger warning for that one, yeah. All right, or how about getting up in front of people and speaking, public speaking? Anybody ever felt, yeah, okay, me too. If you notice, my hand up was for all of those. My hand was up for all of those. In fact, today, honestly, getting to speak with you all is exciting, but it's also a little bit terrifying. Why? Why would Brian Sostek, star of stage and screen, star of stage, okay, I have a performing arts background, we'll leave it at that, okay? But why would I be nervous? Why would there be any fear for me to get up here and talk at convocation? Well, I'm glad I asked, because that brings me to where my outline says I should be, which is fear. Time-wise, we're doing great. Okay, first off, I have nothing against fear. Fear is comes in really handy sometimes. In fact, let me tell you a tale about fear from the theater. All right. So the setting, it was the summer of 1986. Most of you were toddlers about 20 years after this happened. and I know you're doing the math right now, I'm 73, but I act 57. There you go. Anyway, I was living in a small Midwestern town and I was part of a summer stock theater company known as the Uninvited Company. Anybody ever heard of that? Yeah, it's right here. That's right, it's Carlton Summer Stock Theater. Does it still exist? Maybe, no? We gotta bring it back again. Again, it will, like the phoenix, rise again. All right, so anyway, before the show one evening, I decided I would take a nap. So I set my alarm for 7, which was a half hour before I needed to be at the theater, which was a half hour before the show started at 8, okay? At the time, I was living just 2 blocks away from the Arena Theater, which you can see if you look at an old map of Carleton College. And it happened to be in the house of my parents. It was my parents' place. In fact, my dad's here right now. Hey, Dad. Are you still sensing I'm nervous? Maybe a little bit? Yeah, when I stopped by earlier this morning, he said, I'm enjoying you being nervous. I hope you're still enjoying it. So my parents, by the way, are the ones who told me that when I grew up, I could do anything I wanted except go into the theater. Worked out okay. I mean, that's the reason I got asked to be here at Convo in the first place, so it all comes around. So, back to that summer night, excuse me. Even before the alarm goes up, I wake up, I'm refreshed, I'm ready to go. I look at the clock at 7:55. I look at the clock again. I think that's not right. Time and space are not behaving properly because I definitely set the clock alarm for 7 a.m. My bad, yes. And then the fear kicked in. This is where it gets interesting. So in 7 minutes, I got my shoes and clothes on. I sprinted 2 blocks to the Arena Theater, which was right over there. And I ran into the arena. I ran downstairs to the basement and passed a bunch of company members who then realized, gosh, Brian is not actually somewhere in the building warming up his instrument. He's just running ridiculously late. And then I went into the dressing room, took off my clothes, threw on my costume. Thank God we were doing a modern show. It was John Guare's Landscape of the Body. So all I had to wear was jeans, a t-shirt, and some boots. If we had been doing Shakespeare, Moliere, this would have been a different story. So anyway, I get dressed, I run out to the hallway, I go up the spiral staircase to the stage level, Yep, you heard me, a spiral staircase. That was the main way to get from the dressing room to the stage. That's just one of the many reasons they tore the joint down. And I ran onto stage literally just in time to deliver my first line. 7 minutes, thanks to fear. So fear can be useful. Yeah? In fact, it has been and probably always will be a really essential part of human survival. That's good, solid fear. But what I'm talking about is bad, flimsy fear. And for the purposes of talking with strangers, the way I describe bad, flimsy fear is the fear of something that hasn't happened, isn't happening, and probably, if you slow down and think about it, won't happen. Now, let's get back to the example of public speaking. Public speaking often tops the list in the US of things that are most feared. Yeah? Ahead of death. People literally say, I would rather die than get up there and speak. And they mean it literally, not figuratively. Why is that? Okay, this is another question and answer part. So why do people fear public speaking so much? What do you think it is? Any ideas? Yes. Judgment? Thank you for making this a shorter exercise than it had to be. That was good. No, very good. Judgment. We fear judgment, but why? Yeah, you're going to say something? Oh, imposter syndrome. That's when you feel like you don't really belong up on stage at the chapel delivering the convocation speak because who are you really? Yeah. Imposter syndrome, which gets back to judgment. Yes, go ahead. You cannot predict, oh my gosh, I was gonna talk about ambiguity, because ambiguity, I mean, you never know, right? But I didn't have time. But yes, you're right. You can never predict it. It keeps coming back to judgment. Keeps coming back to judgment, right? So what's the problem with judgment? What happens, for instance, what happens if you do really badly and you get judged? What happens? This is, yes, people boo you, and then what happens? This is what we do in class. We go, yes, go ahead, you wanna give it a shot? Go ahead. What's that? You get excluded. Yeah, or do you? It feels like you will get excluded. That's a great answer. In fact, this is a vestige of a really useful survival instinct. All right, let's go back 60,000 years ago. If you were not valuable to your group, right, your clan, your tribe, whatever, you'd get kicked out. You're dead weight. We can't drag you along. All right, so forget food, forget shelter, forget procreating, your line is done. Yeah, you would get excluded. So I want you to just take a minute here. So let's talk in 60,000 years ago, but it goes back before that. I want you to take a minute and think about the approximately 2,500 generations of ancestors you have going back to 60,000 years ago, who somehow each generation managed to stay in a group, procreate, and continue the line. You have a lot of thanks to give for all those people. That's a lot of staying in groups. And that is why this instinct is so firmly embedded in our brains. We don't want to get excluded. And yet, let's think about modern times, all right? How many of you have ever given a mediocre speech or played a wrong note at a piano recital or struck out at a Little League game and then gotten kicked out of your family? Oh boy, okay, we need to talk later. I'm sorry to hear about that. Maybe you shouldn't talk with me. Where's the chaplain? There you are, Skylar. Okay. I'll connect you two of you for later. Okay. So that's the weird thing, is we have this really powerful, really strong instinct that we are going to get excluded from the group. But really, for the most part, this sort of thing doesn't happen. However, this strong instinct is so strong that it turns out to be one of the biggest obstacles to talking with strangers, I've found. All right, so here's an example I've heard from many students, and maybe some people here have this. Excuse me. I've heard numerous times that some people will go to a store, a bricks and mortar store, where they know something actually exists at the store, and they will not ask a store employee for help finding it because they don't want to bother the employee and get judged. That's weird to me, but okay, it's some people feel that. Or here's another example, and this is a worse one. Some of my students at the University of Minnesota have told me that they're hesitant to go and talk with professors during office hours because they don't want to bother them and be judged. I hope that doesn't happen here. I'm sure it doesn't. If it does, I don't want to know about it. Good, I'm not knowing about it. Or here's a way worse example. As Colin mentioned, one of the things I do these days is help scientists get better at communicating. And I was helping a brain surgeon develop a presentation on stroke survival. And he told me, this is a guy who saves lives on the daily. Like, meh. He literally has this kind of blasé attitude about it. He said the one thing that would help him do his job better is if people would call 911 sooner when it comes to a stroke. And the one reason, and he told me this, the one reason that people don't call 911 sooner is because they don't want to bother the 911 operator and get judged. Can you imagine? It's like, oh yeah, sure, you think this is really an emergency? I mean, come on, sure, your balance is off, your eyes can't focus, one of your arms is dangling, your face is drooping, okay, fine. We'll call the operator, but let's make it quick. I mean, what is this, a Minnesota thing that people don't call 911? I don't know. I haven't investigated this in other parts of the country, but this is coming from a guy who does this for a living, okay? And he has investigated this. That's a huge problem. It's a huge problem that people don't call. So in each of these cases, the store, the professor, the 911 operator, and for the most part, whenever you are talking with strangers in general, there really isn't that much judgment, or definitely nowhere near as much judgment as we, who, you know, we're all the stars of our own movies. We all think that everybody's always looking at us. There's not that much judgment there. There really isn't as much as we think there is. In fact, not only is there judgment, not judgment, but for the most part, there's also not danger. And now I need to do a quick little public service announcement for any lawyers who work at Carleton, all right? If you feel like a specific stranger with whom you'd like to speak might be dangerous, maybe don't speak with that stranger. Honestly, you gotta trust your instincts, okay? Do what you need to do eventually, and you know, there's 8 million, billion other strangers out there. You got plenty of opportunities. But this brings up a question that I like to ask in class and of my clients oftentimes when we're talking about speaking anxiety. How do you tell the difference between something that's scary and something that's dangerous? Right? I mean, something that's scary can be anything from scary to transformative. And something that's dangerous can be anything from scary to dead. So it's good to know the difference. Fair. But when it comes to social interactions, a lot of people just conflate those two automatically, and they assume that when they're scared, they're in danger. And when they're in danger, then they retreat. You know, and they don't talk to people. And granted, they're probably not dying a lot, but they're also probably missing a lot of amazing opportunities to make connections, connections that could be transformative. So let me give you a little story about scary. 2021, September, the University of Minnesota had gotten back to classes in person, but everybody was wearing masks. And every building at the university campus had signs on all of the doors, entrance doors, saying, mask up, remember to mask up, big signs, big posters. Well, I had just finished teaching and I was sitting outside the Mayo building, which is a building that houses classrooms, offices, and a hospital. I'm sitting there eating an apple before I ride my bike home, and I see this guy come out of the doors, kind of walks out, big guy out of the doors. He stops, turns around, walks back into the last door, rips down the mask up sign, crumples it up, throws it on the floor, and then walks back out. And I think, this is gonna be interesting. And I say, excuse me. And he goes, yeah. And then I think, this is gonna be scary. And it was scary. Because now I know that that guy senses a threat. He thinks I am a threat to him, he doesn't know who I am, and I've busted him on ripping down a University of Minnesota official sign. So I walk up to him and slowly I start asking him questions, making sure he knows I'm not really a threat. And at the same time, I'm trying to assess how much of a threat he is, because he's a bit of a wild card, somebody who just rips a sign down and chucks it on his way. But eventually, you know, I get to understanding him a little bit. And he explains that, well, when he's around patients, he absolutely wears a mask, but when he's in his office by himself, alone, he takes his mask off. And nowadays, that's kind of standard practice. Back then, though, it was assault to social norms, at least at the University of Minnesota. And he basically was just frustrated with the fact that his autonomy was being threatened. He was being told what to do. And we saw this manifest lots of ways in vaccine hesitancy and refusal to wear masks, et cetera, et cetera. We can talk about that a whole nother time. One of my favorite things to talk about when it comes to science communication is oppositional audiences. Ooh, gets exciting. I don't see the protesters yet. I was hoping, well, okay, we'll see. Okay, so one of the ideas I really want to get across when I teach the class and today is that stranger does not inherently mean danger, despite one of the worst catchphrases ever to catch on in the US. Now, stranger means, well, we actually spend quite a bit of time in class trying to define what is a stranger. But for our purpose here today, let's just agree that someone who is strange, a stranger to you, is unfamiliar. Fair? Okay? They're unfamiliar. And the unfamiliar can feel really uncomfortable. Yeah, let's do a quick little experiment to demonstrate that. If you can, I just want you to lace your fingers like this. Maybe you've done this game before, I don't know. Now, once you've done that, I want you to switch your grip so that the other thumb is on top. How's that feel? We got a grumpy face, we have like a scowling, yeah, some people get, don't like that, right? Go ahead, you can put your hands back the way it feels good, that's all right. Or you can just relax, let go. So what's going on there? Well, this is a real simple demonstration. Yeah, you shake it off, that's right. Don't worry. All right. This is a real simple demonstration of what's known as Hebb's Law, which is that neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, the more you do something the same way, the stronger the neural network you build to enable you to do that thing more easily. Yeah, and this isn't a big problem when it comes to lacing your fingers. It's not a big problem when it comes to, you know, tying your shoes. You probably do it the same way every time. It's not a big problem when it comes to walking from your dorm to your first class on the same route you take every time. It saves time, it saves energy. That's all good. It's not a problem there. But when it comes to social interactions, defaulting to the familiar and the comfortable, well, that can cause some big problems. We all know that the echo chambers that we all exist in, you can't deny it, we all exist in our own little echo chambers one way or another. Those echo chambers, we gravitate towards them because they're familiar, they're comfortable, they feel good. Yeah? I mean, anybody think they don't exist in any kind of echo chamber? All right, so we admit that's true, right? And as an extra bonus, when we say something to that group of people who form our echo chamber and they agree with it, well, that affirms our value to the group. So it's a win-win situation, double bonus, yeah? And it's fear-free. It's comfortable, it's good, it's nice, but fear-free is a far cry from fearless. Avoiding strangers and anything that challenges your worldview is a great way to stay fear-free. But my hope is that today, and every time I teach classes or work with clients, I get you to be a little bit more fearless. Now, I might succeed, I might not succeed. And that brings us to failure. Okay, I'm gonna proceed as though we have spent a semester together talking about fear. We've talked about it enough, we don't have to talk about it anymore. Or maybe just a little bit more, okay. I'm gonna propose that we proceed that way because A, we don't have a lot of time, and B, I have another story from the theater I would like to share with you. So you know what, you're gonna get what you wanted. The first time I created an evening length piece was with a friend who then went on to become a clown in Cirque du Soleil. Pro tip, if you're ever gonna collaborate with people, collaborate with really talented people. Makes you look really good. I've done that a couple times. Not crazy. My wife's back there. She's my main collaborator. Now, after the show, we got a lot of feedback, and I would like to say that we got a lot of good feedback. I would like to say that, but I can't because I don't remember any of it. All I remember is one thing one guy said in the lobby afterwards. He said, kind of felt like an inside joke. Yeah, right? Oh, that was horrible. I mean, if I could, I would enact a death scene right here, right now, you know, to demonstrate the mortal wound that my soul suffered in that very moment. But I don't have enough space. I need much more space than this for a death scene. Or time. Maybe later, during the Q&A. Okay, anyway, The point is, I had worked really hard to create a show that would get my audience to think and to feel, and what I got instead was, man, I don't get it. And it sucked. Failure sucks. That's the nature of failure. And, you know, it hurts even more when it makes you feel like you are less valuable to the group. For instance, a group of audience members who have now shelled out some cash to buy a ticket and then plunked their butts down in a seat for an hour and a half to watch you. And now they didn't get it. Wow, you're not valuable to them. You are gonna get excluded. That's what it feels like. You're gonna get kicked out. But even if it doesn't involve other people, when you fail, it feels crappy. And why is this? So let's just take a moment, because I think it's worth understanding when it comes to talking with strangers. It's worth understanding why it feels crappy to fail. And very simply put, it's because your brain likes to feel right. There we go. that was easy, right? My wife's nodding back there. Yeah, she knows my brain really likes to feel right. Well, basically what's going on is our brains are excellent prediction machines. This is how we function in the world. We have to. This is how it works. We gather data, we remember it, we process it, we use it, and we predict, all right? And this is how, as babies, we're just doing a lot of data gathering, and as adults, we have a lot of data and we do a lot of prediction. So I remember one time watching my son, Misha, when he was a little baby, sitting on the beach, and he took a handful of sand, and he put it in his mouth, and he spit it out. And I'm like, okay, he's cute, he's a baby. And then he grabbed another handful of sand, and he put it in his mouth, and he spit it out, and I'm like, come on, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice. Why are you putting sand in your mouth? You already did that. A third time, he picks up a handful of sand. Light bulb. He gets really close to his face, and then he thinks about it, makes a prediction. That's probably not gonna taste so good, and he drops the sand. Boom, my son the genius, yeah? Okay, so that's when prediction works. But what about when prediction doesn't work? What happens then? Okay, so if you're able-bodied and you can walk up and down stairs, I want you to answer me this question. How many times have you approached a set of stairs, either going down or going up, stopped at the stairs and go, that first step looks like it's about a 7-inch rise, about a 10-inch tread. I'm gonna start with my right, now I'll go with my left foot. Left foot, good. Next one's about the same. I'm gonna go with my, you don't do that, right? It would take forever, you would be stuck. You wouldn't have made it here today. You probably wouldn't have made it out of first grade, really. You'd be stuck somewhere in your school going, okay, next step, right? Okay, so prediction works great when it works. And most of you who can walk up and down stairs, you don't even think about it. Your brain just goes, don't worry, I got this. You go on up and down, talk on the cell phone if you want, talk to your friends, talk to some strangers, doesn't matter, just go. But have you ever gotten to that last step and it's just a little bit taller or a little bit shorter than all the other ones? What happens? What's that? Trip, you trip. Maybe you stumble, maybe even fall. But even if you don't fall or stumble, you trip and it doesn't feel good because your prediction failed, your expectations were unmet. And you know, whether stumbling on a step or creating a show that does not connect with your audience the way you hoped it would, or talking with strangers and it doesn't go quite the way you thought it might, it doesn't feel good when your predictions aren't met, right? This is unmet expectations. I did not make this up. I can't take credit for it. The Buddha made this up. Yeah, it's the second noble truth of Buddhism. Suffering exists because of unfulfilled expectations. Yeah, I'm quoting the guy, all right? So we know this is true. Now, the Buddhist solution is don't have expectations. Doesn't work for me. I'm sorry, I have tried. I have tried many times. I can't do it. I have expectations. So the way I suggest to my students, my clients, deal with this, I say, go ahead and have expectations, as long as one of those expectations is that some of your expectations will be unmet. Okay, you know, fair balance. Until you reach enlightenment, it's a good way to go. So how does this apply to talking with strangers? Well, you remember how I tried to start the conversation in the MRI waiting room with a bunch of people? Yeah. I wasn't thinking to myself, this is probably gonna go great. And probably in a blink of an eye, all six of us will be best of friends. I was not thinking that. I was thinking, what's the worst that could happen? I mean, we're all sitting around in open back hospital gowns. It's not like they can kick me out of the cool kids club, right? Nobody was cool there. In other words, every social interaction is really an experiment. It really is. And even with people you think you know, and by the way, maybe even more so with people you think you know, that actually is the full title of the class I teach. It's Fear, Failure, and Catastrophe, How to Talk with Strangers and People You Think You Know. But we don't have time for people you think you know today. We just have time for strangers, so we're sticking with strangers. Now, interestingly, most people, when they're interacting with strangers, will predict sand rather than something else. Because sometimes, the experiment actually goes really well, right? Sometimes, instead of sand, you get a taste of, you know, Belgian dark chocolate truffle, maybe. And then maybe you want another taste of that, maybe another, and another, and pretty soon you're married and have two kids, right? And how did that happen? Well, talking with strangers. So people tend, though, to predict sand, not chocolate. And there are lots of studies about this. Okay, so people think that others will judge them more or care less about them than they do. People think that others aren't as cooperative as they are. People think that when they are kind to others, it doesn't have the impact that it actually does. Now, as I was doing this, I'm enough of a geek that I wrote citations. I cited all those studies. And that last one, and this was just real quick, going through the library of articles I've read, I just threw six citations in that last one, just the one about kindness. If you're curious, hit me up. I'll give you the citations. But of course, these bad predictions, predicting the sand rather than chocolate, are due largely to the negativity bias that we all have to some extent. It's the same reason that I remembered that one bad comment after the show instead of the rave reviews that I'm sure we got from everybody else. It's a survival technique. We focus on and remember more the negative occurrences than we do the positive ones. It's survival, and it all comes back to being based on fear. And at one point, it was useful, but when it comes to strangers, I don't think so. Okay, now, I did just say fear, and I said I wasn't gonna talk about fear very much more, but I'm gonna talk about it just a little bit more because I have yet to get to talking about catastrophe. Catastrophe, all right. Sometimes, we know everything just falls to pieces. It just happens. I have lots and lots of theater stories about just that. Not time right now to tell all of them, nor one of them. It just goes on and on. Things just fall apart sometimes. And what do you do in a catastrophe? The best you can. That's really all you can do. So the way I talk about it in class, define the difference between catastrophe and failure. Failure is when you prepare to do something and it doesn't work out. So for instance, and then you can usually learn from it too. So I'm gonna try to talk with these people in the MRI waiting room, and I'm gonna start with the person next to me. And well, that didn't work out. Okay, next time I'll try something different. Like, I won't try to start that conversation. Okay, that's failure. Catastrophe is when you're not prepared for something at all. You don't even see it coming. Who knows? Like, for instance, the time I got cornered by a guy in a bodega in New York City when I was in the back, just looking to buy a beer, and he kept trying to bait me into calling him a racial slur. That was a catastrophe. Or the time that I accidentally, picked up a sex worker in Minneapolis in my car because I thought this person actually needed a ride to get somewhere. And she got rather upset when she realized that she was not gonna close the sale. Okay, that was a catastrophe. Completely unprepared. I wasn't trying to go into this for anything. It just, boom, kind of happened to me. Now, because this talk is called Fear, Failure, and Catastrophe, because it's not called Fear, Failure, and Catastrophe, all the things that suck about talking with strangers, I think I should tell you, give you a couple of tips, some techniques that I offer for, how to talk with strangers, some things you could try to use in the real world. So, let's start with catastrophe, where I just left off. What do you do when you're not prepared? You do something, actually, that I learned right here at Carleton College while working with a survival training club called Kujokra. It still exists? You've heard of it? Yeah, Kujokra, for those of you who don't know, is an improvisation company. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I teach my students and I teach my clients improvisation. Not comedy, that costs a lot extra. I teach them improvisation. And here's how you do it. It's pretty simple. You pay attention to what people are saying and doing. You yes and that, you build on it. And then you repeat. Seems simple, right? Fair? Huh? You want to get up here and try it? Huh? We'll give you a suggestion. No, don't worry. It is simple, and yet it's not simple. It's pretty hard to do consistently and do it well. But if you practice enough, and anybody can do this, if you practice enough, you begin to hear something known, what we call in improv, as offers. Now, an offer is something that somebody might say or do or indicate that you might not pick up on if you weren't paying attention. So for instance, if you walk into a room and a friend of yours is sitting there and you say, hey, how you doing? And they go, fine. They just gave you a bunch of offers. They're probably not doing fine. They sighed, put their hands in their pocket, they shrugged, they said it in a sad tone of voice. Or if you walk into a room and your friend is there and you say, hey, how you doing? And they say, I am fine. They're probably more than fine. Once again, you hear the offers. You see what I'm saying? These exist all the time. People give each other offers all the time. But most of the time, we don't hear them because we're not listening carefully enough. Now, I have had the real great opportunity and the pleasure of working with an organization called Effective Arts. And Effective Arts has one job. We train people who work at organ procurement organizations how to talk with people about donating organs. This means they're going in and talking to families who've just lost a loved one, friends, emergency room doctors, funeral home directors. They're talking to complete strangers in one of the most high-pressure jobs I can even imagine. They get called all hours of the day. They have a very small window of opportunity in which to make this happen because organs are only viable for so long once a person has died. And there's a lot on the line. Up to 8 different people's lives can depend on getting organs from someone who has just died. It is a tough, tough job. And what we do is we work with them on how to listen for offers and how to build on what people are saying and how to eventually ask for the biggest favor you can imagine asking. And when the people say yes, imagine how valuable to the rest of humanity they feel. One whole class, we talk about asking for favors and the impact it can have on other people when they can actually provide the favor. It's pretty powerful. Instead of bothering people, you actually make them feel more valuable. So this improv technique, this listening and yes-anding, it works really well when talking with strangers, obviously. And I've used it to pretty good effect myself. So the guy in the bodega, the one who cornered me and was trying to get me to use racial slurs, I just kept yes-anding and listening and yes-anding, and he eventually bought my beer. He said, your money's no good here. And he bought my beer. And the owner of the bodega was like, and I was like, and I walked out with a beer. And the sex worker, the sex worker that I had disappointed, and well, that's a phrase there, isn't it? Yeah, I didn't think I would ever say that, let alone in front of a bunch of strangers, and now it's recorded for posterity. There we go. The sex worker I had disappointed, she calmed down, and she even left the car with a freshly baked chocolate chip cookie that I had in a tin. Now, it doesn't always have to be transactional like that, but, you know, it helps. So speaking of parting gifts, I'm looking at the time here. I want to offer you one more technique for talking with strangers before I go. And we talk about this all the time in class. And it seems kind of obvious, but one of the ways to reduce the degree of strangeness you have with someone is to find a connection. Yeah, seems obvious, right? So sometimes the connections are really obvious. You know, you're both walking towards the ball spot and you both have a frisbee. Oh, well, there you go, connection. You're both at the same concert singing along and you see each other singing the same song at the same time. Boom, connection. You both came to convo, and you're both nodding your head at the same time, going, this guy is amazing. I want to hire him to come to my, no, okay, that's a connection, there we go. But it's weird how often those potential connections are all around us. They're just waiting to be discovered, just under the surface. So for instance, Here's one that sometimes works. Is anyone here celebrating a birthday today? Does anybody have a birthday today? Okay, I have a backup question. Does anyone here know Taylor Swift? Okay, there we go, see? Connection. No, sometimes the birthday thing works, sometimes it doesn't. In fact, when I do workshops and classes, some of the ones I do, I'll have people start by introducing themselves, their area of research, and then something about themselves that no one else in the room knows. And I've done this for specific workshops, I've done this every time. And every time, even when I had, I think, as few as 7 people, somebody would say something about themselves that nobody else in the room know, and somebody else would go, wait a minute, you what? You lived in Ukraine for a while and that's where you learned to knit that sweater? I learned Ukrainian knitting from my grandmother, right, whatever. It always leads to something. And then I have to shepherd them back into the workshop. But it's pretty amazing. These things are just under the surface, all around us, all the time. So here's a story, my last story of the day, about a connection that was just under the surface that is not as simple as knitting or having the same birthday. This is more of a transformative connection that led, a connection that led to a transformative experience. My son survived first grade, stopped eating sand, went to school. He went to a new school, and he didn't know anybody there, first year. And finally, some kid asked him if he wanted to come to his birthday party at a place called the Big Thrill Factory, which is like the opposite of any place I ever want to be. The indoor laser tag, it's loud, you know, you got the habit trail, all sorts of stuff. But I said, oh, of course we're gonna go. Yes, let's go. So we went, I brought a laptop because I thought I was gonna do some work, and then I'm there going, oh God, okay. I just wasn't in a mood to talk with strangers. That happens, right? You get exhausted sometimes. But I thought, well, I should get to know some of the parents. Fair. So I look around and I see the different parents there and I think, okay, let's make this interesting. Who's the person I am least likely to connect with? And I see this guy. Now, we're both white and male, and that's about as far as it goes, all right? He's kind of wearing a shirt and tie. This is the middle of the day. He's at a birthday party. He's in a shirt and tie, and he's just kind of standing in there like this. And I think, okay, I'll go up and talk to this guy. So I go up and talk to him, introduce myself, learn a little bit about him, discover that he has just moved to town. His kid is fairly new to school as well. Why'd you come to town? Oh, well, I'm the new CEO of Be The Match. Do you know what Be The Match is? It's the National Bone Marrow Donor Organization. This is located in Minneapolis. They handle all the bone marrow donation in the US and other parts of the world as well, believe it or not. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. And we got to talking more and more, and I started asking some really pointed questions about marrow donation. He said, why do you know so much about donation, the donation world? And I said, well, I happen to work with this organization called Effective Arts. Yeah. And he said, oh, that's interesting. What do you do? And I told him. And he said, well, that's really interesting because we are having a really hard time. We're not getting as many donors to follow through on the donation, specifically when it comes to donating to patients who are of African ancestry. And I said, oh, really? What's going on there? He said, we're just not talking to him right. I don't know what's going on. And I said, well, maybe we can help you. And he said, maybe. Well, it turns out Effective Arch, which happens to be based in Arizona, was going to be in Minneapolis the next week. So I talked to the owners. We got together. We put together a little demonstration of what we do. Yeah. We do this, they needed an actor. Again, goes back, yeah. They needed an actor to help portray this and help do the training. And then the next Tuesday, we got together with Be The Match, the leaders of Be The Match, and we showed them how this would work. And they said, yeah, we'll take that. And then over the next couple of years, Effective Arts worked with Be The Match on how to more effectively communicate with donors of African ancestry. And you gotta understand, if you have African ancestry, you're gonna have a way more complex genetic background. It's way more diverse. Which means if you are the match for somebody who needs your marrow, it is really rare. For somebody like me, you know, you might find 5 or 6 or 7 people in the US, okay, we're good, any one of you will do. But if you have African ancestry, it often comes down to literally 1 in a million because you have to match a high number of, you have to have a very close match. It has to be a very close biological match. So after a couple of years of doing this, they got better at talking to people. In fact, one of the things that dawned on him is like, oh, we have no connection. We need to have connection. So what do? You get people of African ancestry talking to people of African ancestry. Duh, all right? There's a bigger conversation about how the US medical system and history has a few problems in that world. Anyway, they got better and better. Their numbers started going up. The donors started saying yes more and more, and people's lives started getting saved. All because I talked to a stranger, yeah? Found some kind of connection, and boom, that's where it went. Now, excuse me, one more sip here. I want to leave you finally with something that I hope will make us all feel a little more connected and a little less like strangers. I have it right here. It is, it's the bust of a German philosopher and playwright named Schiller, but it's made out of butter. Yeah, this isn't the real one. Some people's heart rate got a little hot there, right? Yeah, back there, were you about to jump up? Yeah, that's okay. Well, I tell you what, you can have this one, okay? There you go. I would not eat it. It's been around for a while. You can ask me about the whole story, but there is a butter Schiller for you. And now you can all say that we have been in the same room with Schiller, all right, at Carlton Convo, and nobody got chased or tackled. It was pretty good. I would like to thank you all for being here, for coming through the rain and joining us, or logging onto Zoom, which I know is a thrill for all of those of you who are, I don't even know where the camera, I guess it's there. Hi, friends. I want to thank you for being here, for participating, for giving me your time and your energy. And I'd be delighted to continue the conversation, hear your thoughts, answer any questions you have, and if you request, do a death scene or tell you another story from my life in the theater and talking with strangers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Brian. And yes, we're going to open it up to Q&A in just a second here, but just to mention the convos coming up, we only have two convos left of the regular convo series. Next week will be Pipo Nwendoye, Carleton class of 83, fine art photographer, professor of photography at Oberlin College. Then on May 10th, we have our food insecurity convocation with Jill Conklin, director and strategic officer of Food for Soul, an international nonprofit organization founded by chef Massimo Botturo and Laura Gilmore. That will also be the date of Empty Bowls. So we all know what Empty Bowls is, and if we don't, we can talk later. It's the 20th anniversary of Empty Bowls as well. So, convo luncheon. There is room at the table. If you would like to eat chicken parm with us, if you're a community member, if you're a staff, faculty, student, please talk to me afterwards. Help us eat the chicken parm and the cobbler and the other foods as well. We'll continue the conversation with Brian. We can possibly talk to strangers, and we can maybe find out about his degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon.
That's really far.
A little more separation.
Yeah, but let's get to the Q&A. Four degrees of separation, yeah.
Okay, but we're gonna start right back here.
You wanna know how you can pick up the Schiller? I'll just have it here waiting for you.
Hello, thank you for talking. I really appreciate your talk today. Oh my gosh, I'm really nervous.
I know, you know what? Isn't that weird? Because you're talking in front of strangers. We're all gonna judge you. Everybody turn and look, we're gonna be judgmental.
One of the things that I think a lot about is like the role of fear in motivating you to do things. And I think fear can be a very potent motivator to kind of push yourself. But I was just wondering if you have any thoughts on when fear is too much, or when you're pushing yourself too much and you should kind of retreat more into that comfort zone instead of being in that stretch zone.
That's a great question. You know, one of the first things I talk about when I do a workshop on speaking anxiety, one of the very first things I talk about is the fact that there is a difference between state anxiety and trait anxiety. And state anxiety is what's brought about when something makes you nervous, and trait anxiety is something that you need to talk to a doc about. So that in between there, there's a range of stuff going on. And really, that's a question that you need to figure out, because I can't. We all have different levels with different thresholds. You know, this morning I was at near the top of my threshold, yeah? And I don't want to get any more anxious than that, typically. And oftentimes, when I'm teaching a class, I will be near the bottom of my threshold. And so you kind of have to sense what that is. But I guess the easiest way to determine, you said it's a great motivator to get things done, and if it starts impeding your progress or making the quality of your work less good, then that's a pretty good sign that, you know, you need to calm down, yeah? Release some of your expectations. Easier said than done, but there's my 2 cents, all right?
Hi, thanks for your talk today. I really enjoyed it. One thing I've sort of been wondering about is this idea that separate from the fear of like being judged yourself is the fear that other people don't want to be talked to by strangers. And to some extent, I'm sure this is just like my own projection, but like especially younger people like myself, I sort of get this sense, and I wonder sort of what you think about that and how you would go about addressing that.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that you personally feel that sometimes, like you just don't want people to talk to you, right? And generally you've sensed that particularly younger people, and I'll say, yeah, all sorts of people don't want to be talked to at different times. So we talk about this in class. A lot of times students will say, well, how am I supposed to start going to talk to strangers if I don't know they want to be talked to? Fair. That gets back to A, the experiment. You never know. And what's the worst that can happen? Somebody can say, leave me alone. Okay, fair enough. That has actually happened. I've had students say, you know, I tried talking. By the way, every week for this class, I give students a challenge, typically in 3 levels of risk. And I just ask them to give it a shot and then, you know, tell us about what happened. And one of them, in the very beginning, is just to say hi to a stranger. And for some people, that's a lot. And I've had students come back and say, you know, I said hi to somebody, and they just grumbled at me. Okay, well, you never know. You never know what's going on in somebody else's head. You never know what battles they're fighting. You just never know. So the first thing is, the more you do this, the better you get at it. The more sense you get of like, does somebody want to even be approached or not? Second of all, the more you do it, the more you get a sense of somebody's response. Okay, so in the MRI waiting room, I tried. This woman did not want to be spoken with. Yeah, she just wanted to be left alone. But to make it extra weird, by the way, for some reason in this waiting room, they had some normal chairs and then they had some high chairs. And I was on a high chair. That was all that was left. So I'm sitting there in a gown, looking down at the next woman next to me going, hey, so I heard you traveled to Portugal. No, she didn't want to talk, right? Now with young people, especially, interestingly, our family was just in Chicago. We were looking at different colleges for my son to, you know, possibly attend. And we were at Loyola and we were a little bit lost. So there was a student, ostensibly a student, young woman, walking along with her, you know, headphones on. And I said, excuse me. My son was watching this. I said, excuse me. And she was like, she was shocked that I even, you know, would raise my finger. She was shocked. And I said, excuse me. And she pulled her earphones off. I said, can you tell us where the so-and-so building is? And she said, oh yeah, sure. Remember the power of asking favors? You make somebody feel valuable. And then she just jumped right into it. So I have found personally, and I do this all the time at the U, the University of Minnesota, I talk with young people, strangers, a lot. I've found that if you approach people with an openness and you know, no malicious intent, most people are gonna be fine with that. And if they're not, move on to the next 7,999,999,999 people. Fair? Does that help? Yeah? Okay, cool, all right. Yes?
Brian, I don't have a question. I have a thank you. I want you to remember the summer of 1987, Young's Paint Center, the address 1416 Pioneer Court.
Yeah.
And painting a room for my daughter. Thank you.
Oh, well, you're welcome. I hope I didn't lose too many brain cells that summer. It was no, you're welcome. Yeah, I painted houses during the summer and during breaks to help, you know, pay for part of college and buy a crappy little car. There we go. We got a question down here.
We do. This might be our last one. We
all righty.
Shall see.
I'll stick around if you want to talk more. We can talk at the lunch, too.
For starters, thank you again, Brian, for coming and talking to us today. The question I have, you briefly talked about the power and importance of kindness in talking to strangers and the studies that you alluded to about what science has to say about the importance of kindness. So I was wondering if you could expand a little more on that.
Yeah. I love that question. It's a great way to end. It is really easy to be kind to people. It is really, really easy. In fact, one of my favorite quotes of all times, the Dalai Lama said, whenever possible, choose kindness. It is always possible. And even if you're at your wit's end and you are in a bad mood and you're really anxious, maybe you're at the top of your threshold like I was this morning, and I pulled out of my alley and a car half a block away, laid on the horn. I don't know who was on there, but they just laid on their horn as they drove the half block towards me and past me. And the first thing I thought was, you can because, you know, I was at the threshold. And then I just started rewriting a story. What's going on there, right? Well, okay, so maybe they're having a crappy, maybe they're having a worse day than I am. I bet they're having a worse day, that poor person and whatever. And then you can be more kind. But the power of kindness itself, it is amazing how often people underestimate this. Like I mentioned a bunch of studies, we can talk about this more, but even the power of smiling at somebody, a stranger, can have a profound effect on that person, which then reflects back on you. People actually feel better when they're kind to other people. And if there's any reason to be kind to people in this day and age, is that people are generally perceived as not kind. But that's bull. People are mostly kind. We just hear about all the crap all the time because it gets news more, right? It's much more interesting, it's titillating, it's the negativity bias. We were drawn to that, we remember it, we record it, yeah? But people are almost always kind when they can be. And you know, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a school shooter. And he said, famously, you know, if just one person had said hi to me in the hall that day, I wouldn't have done it. That's all it takes. I keep, that plays through my head a number of times. I wouldn't say a day, but probably a week. That very thing just plays in my head. And so if there's any reason to be kind to people and any reason to appreciate the power of it, it's that. Just think, all you gotta do is say hi to somebody, smile at somebody, and you just don't know what the ripples of that could end up being. Yeah? That's as much as I'll expand on it right now, and we could talk about the studies if you want the specifics of them. Yeah, all right.
We do need to conclude. However, we do have something from Zoom I just want to read to
you.
Oh,
okay,
if I
may. The Zoom question.
This is from Caroline O'Connor, class of 92.
Oh, hey, Caroline.
Uncle alum, and former student of both Brian's parents. And she says, would you please speak a little more on the kind of work you do with nurses and doctors, if you don't mind concluding on that point?
Yeah. Well, I work with lots of researchers, whether they are, doing bench work or they're clinical trials or they're working with patients. And I guess I'll just very quickly say that the first and foremost thing that I do with people who are practitioners is I work on getting them to listen. That is it. Because if you can listen intentionally, and there's an exercise I can show you later that's super simple that shows how easy it is to actually focus yourself and listen intentionally and hear a lot more. I get them to listen. And that what it does right off the bat is causes them to slow down a little bit, stop using their fast system of thinking and rely a little bit more on their slow system of thinking, which then allows patients to feel like they're heard, which then allows a much better collaboration. And we all know that if a patient and a doctor work together, they're gonna do way better than if a patient feels like they don't trust the doc and the doc doesn't have time for the patient, yeah? Or the nurse or whomever. Just doctors tend to be a little more rushed in my experience than nurses. So I'll say that's the brief answer. That's the kind of work that I start on with them. And then it goes all sorts of places. And I'd be happy to chat about that more. If you just email me, you can find me at the University of Minnesota.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Brian, for being here. Thank you all for being here as well.
Thank you. We'll see you next time.